Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. I am joined this week by Mike Lawson, Taryn Sharma, and Stephanie Weissenberger. What's up, gang?
What's up, gang?
How's it going?
So we got a guest this week. We got a packed episode. You know, it was so funny when the week started on Monday. I'm like, there's not really much going on in sports law. Let's talk about where we stand on name, image, and likeness. So we got a lovely guest who will be joining us at the end of the podcast, Andy Schwartz, who is, we'll say, an economist. He's all over the sports landscape. In the interim, what happened between, I guess, Monday and Wednesday, we had a loaded sports law week all of a sudden. So here's the general roadmap for today, guys. We're going to talk about Tom Wilson. We're going to talk about what's going on with the New York Rangers, which has been a wild 72 hours. We're then going to move over to the hardwood. We're going to talk a little to Vanessa Bryant, what's going on in her lawsuit with LA County. And then we're going to go over to, I guess we'll call it boxing YouTube, over with Mike Triller. Is that the right pronunciation? Triller?
Triller.
Triller. Like Triller. Okay.
Like thriller without the H.
Gotcha. You know, that the Triller topic, which Mike will definitely get into. I don't know why, but that is a topic that I got at least seven DMs that we should needed to cover it. So obviously it's something that we needed to get into. And then last but not least, obviously we have Andy Schwartz coming on. So we're going to talk a little bit of name, image, and likeness amongst ourselves, see what our individual thoughts are. And then we're going to bring on the expert, Andy. Number one here, we have Tom Wilson. And I love that we have two Washington Capitals fans. Terrence, I see your Capitals hat. Stephanie loves the Caps. And Mike and I are over here as the resident New Yorkers. So we had a viral incident that occurred on Tuesday night. I think it was it Monday night, guys, the fight, the first fight? I'm losing track of my days. So yeah, Tom Wilson, who we've covered on this podcast before, he punches a Ranger in the head who's face down. I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, but is it Buchnevich?
Buchnevich.
He punches him in the head. Then he throws our friend that we covered on this the podcast, Artemi Panarin, the bread man. He takes his hair and he throws him down. So by my count, that's about 1,000 incidents involving Tom Wilson. The guy is a menace. He wakes up every morning and he chooses violence. And the interesting part about Tom Wilson is the guy's pretty good. Scores a couple goals, helped win a Stanley Cup. This is not your normal enforcer. So I'm going to give it to you, Taryn, Mr. Washington Capitals. Why should Tom Wilson not be kicked out of the sport of hockey? Loaded question, am I right?
Yeah, very loaded. Look, Monday wasn't good. He is a very important player to the Capitals. We'll start there. He's not just some goon. He's not Ryan Reeves. Like, he's a talented player. He can be a point-of-game player, and he's very important to the Capitals' long-term success. Like, they don't win the cup without him. So that's one thing. He has to know at this point, five suspensions deep and
500.
Well, five. Yeah, and he needs to know that the eyes are on him. So, like you mentioned, he punched Buchnevich and then was pulled off by Strom, and then Artemi Panarin jumped on his back. And he overreacted to that. That he should not have thrown him to the ice. He's very, very lucky that nothing happened to Panarin.
Oh, no, something did happen. He's out for the rest of the season.
Okay, look, there's three games left. Panarin came into the game injured. It's not surprising that he's missing games.
This is causation, okay? They teach you duty breach, causation, harm. The hair pull and slam to the ice made him miss the rest of the season.
He's not taking hockey's assumption to the risk, Dan.
Okay, Caps fans, relax.
He's not missing games because of a concussion or something that would have been caused by that. Okay, so the Wilson thing, I don't think is the reason that he's missing these games. I think he's missing these games because they missed the playoffs.
That's not the case at all. But good.
And he came into the game injured. Anyway, look, Wilson shouldn't have done what he did. And I think he should have been suspended. I was listening to Emily Kaplan. She was on with SVP last night.
I saw she replied to you, by the way. I saw that.
Yeah, she made a lot of really good points. But the thing is that what Department of Player Safety looked at is that a suspendable hit. And every night in the scrum, there are crazy things going on. Whether you want to shake your head and say, no, that doesn't happen. There is dirty stuff going on. And they look at that stuff first, and then they gauge up the penalty, the suspension, if it's a guy who is a repeat offender.
Okay, so that's obviously not what they did, because he got a five. Okay, hold on for a second. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt that you're not just speaking as a Caps fan, because, Taryn, I think you're a very smart individual, Caps hat notwithstanding, okay? I'm not disagreeing with any of your analysis here, but there is no chance that they're like, oh, is this something that's normally punished? Oh, it's not normally punished. Let's ratchet up the punishment because it's Tom Wilson, the biggest recidivist in the NHL. And let's give him the punishment. of $5,000. So whatever they ratcheted up to is not a sufficient punishment. $5,000 and no suspension.
$5,000 is for the Buchnevich thing. So he punches Buchnevich.
What does he get for Panarin? Zero?
Nothing. Yeah. They said that that's not a suspendable offense.
Okay. So
it's not like they're rushing to defend Tom Wilson. Okay. The Department of Player Safety is not in Tom Wilson's corner.
Let me give the other side, Steph, and then I'll let you defend your friend, Taryn. Okay. So the other side of this, right. The Department of Player Safety has a lot of discretion here, right? They don't have discretion in the fine. My understanding is that it's a maximum $5,000 fine under the NFL and the NHL CBA, which is what it is. $5,000 fine is an idiotic maximum offense. I imagine during the next CBA that's going to be ratcheted up to a significant number. Why is that a nonsense number? Because someone like Tom Wilson, and really any NHL player, is for the most part, right, going to be making above $1 million. If I made $1 million a year and you fine me $5,000, it's nothing. It's literally pocket change. So that number has to go up. In the NBA, you tamper or any number of infractions, I think, it's 500,000, I think, is the max. I saw there was a fine that occurred back in 2014 when the King, Henrik Lundqvist, formerly of the Rangers, squirted Sidney Crosby with water. Guess what fine he got, guys? Guess what number? $5,000. So those can't be the same amount for a fine. Now, in the NFL, Vontaze Burfict, who I posted this and the tweet got some traction, but I remember this happened, this past year, the pre-COVID year. Vontaze Burfict is a really dirty player. He played for the Bengals. He played for the Raiders. He's leading with his head. He's targeting normal hits that normal guys maybe get a suspension for, two games for, three games for. Vontaze Burfict would get four, then he would get six, and then all of a sudden he got a 12-game suspension. He didn't get it because the hit was that bad. He got it because he was a repeat offender, and that offense kept ratcheting up. So the NHL doesn't want to take that approach. They wanted to give Tom Wilson a normal suspension, or say a normal non-suspension for what occurred. So I think that they're taking the wrong approach here. If they really want to police this out of the game, they got to just, anytime he does something, it's got to be maybe not a normal punishment for that type of offense, but by giving him $5,000 is basically giving him nothing.
All right. I think that the Rangers need to relax a little bit, because Wilson, like, karma was already just paid earlier in the rematch between the Rangers and the Capitals. Wilson was announced that he wouldn't return to the game due to an upper body injury that stemmed from within the first 5 seconds of the game.
They jumped him. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. The Capitals and Rangers fought. Six different Capitals players were, I don't know, body tackled on the ice. Like, the Rangers got their revenge, and Tom Wilson is one of the best players of all time. And
okay.
I
rest. Okay, that's it. That's it.
All right.
That's
all right. Let me say here. I have no sides on this. I'm not a Rangers fan, and I'm not a Caps fan. However, I was happy when the Caps won. I thought that was a lot of fun. And
Mike, are you from New York? What the hell is wrong with you?
No, I'm not a Caps fan. It's fine.
You're wearing a Yankees jersey.
That's right.
Take it off.
So going to what Dan just said about, you cited two different things. You cited a minor offense of squirting somebody in the face with water, assault, if you will. Of $5,000, right? And you're comparing it now to what Wilson did in the scrum, whatever you want to call it. Taryn, to your point of saying that a lot of different things happen, Stephanie, you're saying assumption of the risk for hockey. I get that. It's all fair and well, whatever. These are a lot of arguments in sports. However, what the purpose of these fines are is to disincentivize this to happen again. So what you basically just told the entire NHL is that if I headlock somebody, put them on the ground, and punch the back of their head onto the ice,
sucker punch the back of their head.
Whatever, sucker punch, it doesn't matter. If they're looking at me square in the eyes and I hit them in the face, push them to the ice, whatever, I only get fined $5,000 because they just set a precedent with the action that Tom Wilson took. Now, that is the only issue I have. I don't care if it's a million, like I make $1 million and it's only $5,000. The $5,000 is low no matter what. Even if his salary was $100,000, like, it doesn't matter about percentages at that point. It's you need to set a precedent, because going forward, they have to look back at this one now and say, well, we only gave him $5,000, so it wouldn't make sense to fine this guy $10,000 because he boarded him pretty good. Like, it just doesn't matter. But also on the same level of when you talk about Vontaze Burfict, with his successive penalties here, you have Tom Wilson with his successive penalties. Escalating. In criminal law,
escalating.
In criminal law, you have a thing called persistence. And when you have three felonies, that you can get a higher sentence because of a persistent felony. So that's all the three strikes law, if you will, for a lot of states that have that. But
the NHL should have that. That sounds like a good rule that the NHL should apply.
You know, baseball has it, three strikes and you're out. I don't know why.
That's actually part of a song, Mike. I don't know what you are talking about.
So wait, just think that this needs to set a precedent, and it just doesn't.
Okay. So just quick, and then Taryn, I'm going to let you have the floor back because I see you're itching to get back in. Precedent is one thing. Deterrent is another thing. To Mike, to your point, part of the reason we come up with punishments in criminal law when you're looking at sentencing, there has to be a deterrent. Okay. Nothing has worked with Tom Wilson, right? Everyone's going to be like, oh, Tom Wilson, this isn't so bad. This is hockey. And all these people are calling me soft on Twitter. Do I even watch hockey? And like, you know what? There is fighting in hockey. Does there need to be sucker punches to the head? No, that's not part of the sport. So I'm just a quick history lesson. I'm going to get to the new stuff. Taryn, I promise I will let you get in. I see you itching like Tom Wilson to punch someone in the face. That's how itchy you are right now. Okay. There's Marty McSorley. Okay. There's Todd Bertuzzi. There's some really heinous acts that have occurred in hockey that have resulted in, you know, borderline criminal offenses and guys that have never played hockey again because of what has happened. Now, do I think that anything that Tom Wilson has done in isolation is that bad? No. I think if this Ranger incident, you know, was really bad, like I'm posting the clip and people are like, how is this worthy of assault? And I go, it's not assault. It's not, you know, quality. It's quantity. It keeps happening. So there is no deterrent that has worked for Tom Wilson because he keeps having dirty plays. Bottom line. I mean, maybe this one wasn't as worse and it definitely wasn't. Now, I say that this quantity argument because it helps explain the Rangers statement in this. And there's been a wild 72 hours for the Rangers. So Monday is the fight. Okay. Tuesday is a wild statement that comes from the Rangers Twitter account, the likes of which I've never seen in professional sports, let alone in hockey, professional sports. I'm just going to read the end. Okay. So long and short is NHL player safety gave him this $5,000 fine. They didn't give him that much. Okay. So I'm just going to read the last part of this. Okay. We view this as a dereliction of duty by NHL head of player safety, George Parros, and believe he is unfit to continue in his current role. Okay. Hockey Twitter exploded. They go, we hate the Rangers, but we like the Rangers tonight. This is the greatest thing of all time. And obviously, Cap Schroeder went nuclear, and they're fighting everybody. They're like Tom Wilson. They're punching people in the head. They're going crazy. They're going crazy in my replies and fighting some of my best friends. Not nice, Cap Twitter. You guys are insane, but I respect it. I'm not going to lie. So here's what happens after that. Okay, weird comment from the Rangers. I've never seen that in pro sports. Someone from a team to attack a league official. Very odd. Okay, next one. Ready? Breaking. This is from today. The New York Rangers have fired team president John Davidson and general manager Jeff Gorton. Within one day of this, we'll say 48 hours of the fight, 24 hours in the statement, the team lets go of their president and general manager. Mind you, the Rangers have been a pretty good organization. They're not going to make the playoffs this year, but it's pretty odd timing. So I know, Mike, you tweeted out the clarification that the firing had nothing to do with the statement. I don't buy it. I don't buy it one bit.
I think that that's absolutely true. And there's been multiple sources that said that statement, which also includes the line horrifying act of violence for what Wilson did, which holy overstatement, Batman, was driven by none other than James Dolan. So, you know, he's not actively involving himself in the Knicks day-to-day operations. Now he's moved over to the Rangers side of the house. Look, the point is with this Wilson thing, it's two different incidents. There's the punch to Buchnevich. That's what he was fined for. Okay. Also bad. And then Panarin jumps on his back and he takes it too far. That's also bad. I think that he could have really hurt Panarin. And for that reason, he should have been suspended at least a game, but you know, five games. There's something in between though, like the Caps Twitter account tweeting, like, you know, we wake up and we choose violence. It's the picture of Tom Wilson. It's like, you know, Tom Wilson machine goes burr. Like between that and horrifying act of violence, which, you know, is ridiculous. There's something in between, which is that Tom Wilson did a bad thing and he should have received a commensurate punishment.
Okay. I have a question for the team before we get off this topic. Who's more likely to be fired, Rangers Twitter or Caps Twitter guy?
I have to imagine that the Caps Twitter person was taken.
He's gone. He's gone. Caps Twitter
guy. Because they deleted that tweet so fast.
He's gone. I think it's time that we move over to our next topic. This is an interesting lawsuit over in Los Angeles. So Vanessa Bryant is currently suing Los Angeles County over the improper dissemination of crash site photos of her late husband, Kobe Bryant, her daughter, Gianna Bryant, as well as seven others. These photos were allegedly shared amongst sheriff's deputies and allegedly amongst members of the public. So there's a lawsuit for invasion of privacy that Vanessa Bryant is leading the charge on. Stephanie, what is the latest on that front?
Well, the latest is that the county attorneys filed their answer to this lawsuit on Friday. And they basically said that Vanessa Bryant has absolutely no basis to sue over sharing of photos from the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash scene, which personally, I think they're kind of in the wrong here, because also in that answer, they added some interesting language, but then all of the facts tend to contradict the language that they included in their answer, which doesn't really make sense to me. But they said the county does not condone this showing of accident site photographs and has taken corrective personnel actions accordingly. That does not mean, however, that plaintiff has viable legal claims. Well, my question for them is, but you told all of the deputies who took the photos to just delete the photographs and tried to cover up all of the evidence until the LA Times exposed you, and now you're stuck trying to pick up all the pieces. So, I mean, I think that Vanessa Bryant deserves to have some sort of closure from this case because, you know, as we remember, there were also reports that Vanessa had found out about Kobe's death when the rest of the world found out from TMZ. And so I think that's where you kind of run into issues, which we've talked about before in these high profile cases, is that there's always going to be the invasion of privacy, but it's up to the law enforcement, these sheriff's department and firefighting departments, to implement that law and to make sure that their investigations respect the family of the deceased. And so I think that's where there's an issue here.
Steph, just to clarify, and you bring up a good point. Why is the county saying that, you know, there's no lawsuit here? Because they, at least according to them, at best, one member of the public received these photographs, which I'm not sure if I buy. You know, we spent time at least covering it on social media. Vanessa Bryant tweeted out portions of the complaint, you know, obviously, and it's also publicly available online. But, you know, there's in any number of, you know, instances people are talking about at a bar. One deputy sheriff allegedly took 25 to 100 personal photographs on his cell phone. You don't take that. I mean, this is just, you know, common sense. If you're taking that many photographs and you're sharing them with other people, what are the chances that you're only sharing them within the department? I just find that a little odd. So, you know, the county says, quote, showing an accident site photograph to one member of the public cannot constitute an invasion of plaintiff's privacy under California law. So let's assume that to be true, right? That one person cannot constitute an invasion of privacy. So obviously, what's Vanessa's response here? I'm going to go to town and I'm going to slam you with discovery to try to establish that more than one member of the public knows. So this is a quote from Vanessa's, from the filing, I guess, I think from USA Today. Quote, Vanessa plans to conduct discovery, quote, with more than 40 depositions, forensic examinations of electronic devices and cloud-based storage accounts in the possession of defendants, third parties, and expert reports. So what's Vanessa's plan? To bog the police department down with discovery and to try to get to the bottom of this. So it's going to come out of depositions, who you shared it with, and you're going to get caught under oath. So, yeah, I think it's a very fascinating case, that fascinating turn the case is taking.
Well, you know, there's an interesting case that's actually connected to this lawsuit that was referenced in both the complaint and the answer. And it's about a former Los Angeles County private investigative officer, and he's actually suing the county over the alleged personal phone demand turnover, essentially because he started receiving all of these graphic photos from other people in the department. And when he saw these, he immediately thought, this isn't right. We should not be passing these around. It could be very problematic. So everyone needs to delete them so that we minimize the potential for the content to fall in the wrong hands. And then subsequently, he was then fired after that. And so he actually is, I'm assuming, on Vanessa Bryant's side and tried to take a stand. And the county was like, well, here's this guy who's speaking out about it already. We better try and cover this up really good. And then the LA Times swooped in, as they always do, and released an article.
So I guess before we transition, we covered this in a couple episodes back when we were talking about Vanessa Bryant's plans with Nike and the Mamba brand. You know, I get it every time I mention Vanessa Bryant online. People are like, why is she suing? She has so much money. And I try to tell people this is not It's not about money. If it was about money, Vanessa wouldn't be going after the police department. It's about principle. It's about setting an example. So when it comes to our old case that we talked about with, you know, Vanessa not renewing Nike's deal with Kobe, she's trying to set a brand for herself. She's not going to be pushed around. She's going to make an example, and she's going to be a trailblazer. And I don't know, if you're reading the writing on the wall, I think she, a new, you know, and Mike, you spent a lot of time talking about it, but a new brand's going to emerge. I mean, this is, you know, brand management, brand awareness, whatever you want to call it. Vanessa's making a name for herself and a label for herself that she's going after everybody. Power to Vanessa. I support the cause by all means. So that said, our third topic before we get into name, image, and likeness, Mike, Trilla. I like saying it as Trilla. I know it's not spelled like that, but it sounds so much more fun that way. I know you were all over Jake Paul, Ben Askren. You and I saw a tweet that one of our lovely listeners tagged us in from Front Office Sports. I had no clue of the amount of piracy that was occurring for that fight. I know it was very heavily watched. I think the number is at least 2 million people pirated that fight, which gives you an indication of how many people were really watching Ben Askren take a dive. I said it. Mike, what's going on the Trilla litigation landscape?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a ton here. So it's really broken down into 2 points. So I'll get to the 2 million broadcasts in a second, but what we have is what's really breaking the news now is the publicity of Triller, in the sense that because of a lawsuit that they filed on April 23rd regarding these piracy claims, these copyright infringement. By the way, piracy is just not even fancy. It's another word for copyright infringement. Copyright infringement is the violation of the United States copyright law. So piracy has just kind of made its name around like videos and that kind of element, but it's really just boiled down to copyright infringement. And so with the publicity of what's happening now is Triller Inc. is the company that's been, you know, putting on the pay-per-views for these boxing events that Jake Paul has been a part of the last two, at least.
You love Jake Paul. I can't figure out you, Mike. You're a hater of Jake Paul.
I can't stand Jake Paul. I paid the $50 to hopefully watch him get knocked out. Unless it's somebody like good and like I'm excited about it, I don't know if I will the next time, because he just keeps lining up these dopes who get knocked out in the first round.
Are you buying the Logan Paul fight June 6th? Are we buying that?
Yeah, I think I have to. Just for the Mayweather. Triller now has found that there's been potentially 2 million piracy like streams. So they're now like, we're going to have to sue everybody for violating copyright law. So they've kind of made a post. And if you go to fight.tv, it'll actually pull up the whole thing where it's the Triller Fight Club, Jake Paul versus Ben Askren, and it's their piracy settlement. So basically what they want is you to pay the $49.99 back that you didn't pay originally because you illegally streamed it. And then if you do that, you're basically telling them that you're admitting that you illegally streamed, which I'm a little like hesitant about, like if you read some of the fine print. But anyways, like they're saying that they won't sue you, and they in their publicity say that you could be liable for up to $150,000 in fines and penalties because you watched an illegal stream of this fight. Now, basically what this is boils down to, the legal term, is it's clemency. And most of the time people hear this as pardons. This is a criminal act under the violation of federal copyright law. And they are relieving you of this criminal act as long as you pay them back. So that's where we currently sit with that. I think what's funny too, if you're into YouTube at all, Ethan Klein, his name is H3H3. He has an H3 podcast. He literally admitted 3 times on his podcast that he pirated the video, like illegally watched it. And he's like, I'm so happy I didn't pay for that, blah, 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 blah. So he's named in it too. So you'll see his name on social media and things like that too. I think that's funny, because then he like tweeted out, he's like, I didn't do that. But 3 times prior, he said, yeah. And he even like nodded to his producer being like, yeah, you sent me the link.
You think that they can actually get people to they're going to waste all this money on legal fees to go to court over $50 a person? Or are they just like, how many
100,
I get oh, to oh, pay it?
Well, under the, well, okay. So let me get to the lawsuit then. So I think they don't want to go to court. I think once they realize that there was over, you know, 2 million illegal viewership, they realize, you know, it's going to be a pain to try to just get them in somehow. You know, this is filed under California law, so they're going to have to go everywhere. It's just going to be an absolute nightmare. So I think that's a way of them getting around it, being like, hey, like we will do it, but we won't right now. If you just pay us a $50. So I think for them, maybe that's just one way to recoup before they get into the legal fees. On the other end, what they do have is the April 23rd lawsuit. It was filed, and that's against the 13. Well, it names 13 defendants, but it's 12 of the websites that illegally streamed the fight. And now that some of them are actually familiar, you have heard of them before. Bila Sport, BILASPORT, Bila Sport. They've been under fire for Major League Baseball, NHL, NFL, illegally restreaming those broadcasts as well. They're pretty big. They're known by people to illegally stream.
Not by you, Mike. You only
other games. No, not by me.
You learned them in your research for this podcast.
Yes, just the research purposes. Also in there, they name 100 John Does as unnamed persons in here. Basically what that is it's a direct lawsuit for violation of copyright statute 605 and 553. And what you have with those two is, so 605 is the unauthorized publication of the use of communications. So Triller owns the rights to this communication, the rights to broadcast. You see that on every video before, like you are not authorized to repurpose or restream this for any means whatsoever. And then you have 553, which is the unauthorized reception of a cable service. So that's where you get into the individuals who are receiving and watching the illegal stream. That's kind of twofold. And basically for each one of those, there's statutory damages. So they claim the max, obviously you're going to want to claim the max of damages for a willful violation of these violations. Of each violation, it's up to $100,000 for each violation. And then you have $10,000 on top of that statutory damages. So they claim about $110,000 for each willful violation of 605, which is the unauthorized publication. That's the 12 companies that illegally streamed it. And then you have 553, which is essentially the max, and what they claim the max is $60,000 for each willful violation of unauthorized reception of cable service. And I'm not going to go through like the actual language of what that is. You can go read both 605 and 553, or go to the complaint if you have Westlaw or whatever, because that's where I read it and stuff like that. But basically what I find to be interesting, and I want to hear from you guys, is the UFC has had these issues. Dana White has talked about it all the time, about the fights that he has with his pay-per-view, because this is different than major sports, because major sports have TV companies, right? They broadcast and have TV right deals. This is, the fight is owned and distributed by the whatever company owns that fight. So this is Triller, and then UFC, they own their distribution rights. So that's why you have to pay per view. You have to watch, you have to pay per time you watch that. So Dan, what do you think about the fights that Dana White has had? And then if you're comparing it to now with Triller, what do you make of this?
Number one, I think Dana White, I think I listened to his podcast with Bill Simmons. I think he hates Triller. I know, Mike, I'm saying it wrong, but it sounds so much better.
Absolutely hates them.
You know, we had Jason Cruz on the podcast a couple episodes back, and Cruz explained, I asked him about it, but it was a question of, you know, I think Dana White in the comments on Instagram wrote, like, I have a surprise for mother effers this year. So, like, maybe he has envisioned this type of lawsuit going after people for $50. I know I spoke to a friend of the show, Dylan Harriger, who is the founder of the Student Sports Law Network. He had done some research on this topic. So, you know, I was talking to him offline earlier in the day. Some of the topics that you brought up, Mike, just, let's say, procedurally or administratively. Stephanie, obviously, and I would now work at the same firm. And there's an issue with serving somebody that I have in one of our cases. To sue 2 million people, hypothetically, right? You would have to serve 2 million people, which is not going to happen. So, you know, people could be threatened. You know, if they pay back $50 or else, we're going to sue you. Probably not going to happen. This is not necessarily legal advice, just my prediction. I don't think they're going to sue 2 million people. They'll probably, Mike, to your point, go after the hosts, right? And these various hosts for this. So if you're on Periscope or you're on any, I don't know what Periscope is. I've never heard of it, but to the extent I've heard of it, and I know people watching fights illegally on Periscope or any different channels, you might be
one of the named defendants is it's Lil Brandon. That was one of the sites.
How about Big Brandon? We only get Lil Brandon in here.
Only Lil Brandon. One of the sites' names was just Mike. That was the name of it. Just Mike. So
at Mike.
At just Mike.
This Mike person sounds like a total goon. Definitely not Mike Lawson, though.
Yeah, definitely not.
I know, because I paid $50 to watch that train wreck.
It's fascinating to follow. I think the reason, and I'm just, I'm spitballing here, but we get a lot of requests for this particular topic. And I think people maybe looking for some free legal advice. What should they do, right? Should they pay the $50 or should they wait for a lawsuit to be filed against them? So here's my advice, right? This is my non-legal advice, because you shouldn't be listening to me. This is a free podcast. If you want to pay me, I'll give you some real advice. But I don't see them suing individually 2 million people. I don't see it happening. You know, if you're the host, it's a totally different ballgame, but I just don't see them suing 2 million people. No one's ever done that for this type of fight. Maybe Dana White with his pockets will do it, but I don't see Trilla doing it.
I don't see that happening either, but the way that they say that they are going to do that is basically they're getting the VPN of the 12 sites, and they are going to request the IP addresses of every single person who streamed that VPN
Listen to how they would do it, though, and then I want to give over to NIL. But you'd have to basically have these sites cooperate. So you're suing the site, right? And I guess during the course of discovery, you would be asking for these individual IP addresses, which it's a lot, right? It's a lot of work. I'm not denying that they can do it. I just don't think they're going to do it. You want to know why, Mike? No. You want to know why? Because Triller, they have to sell fights. What are you going to be doing for your brand if you sue 2 million people that wanted to engage with your product? It's not that smart. Do you want to go after the host, right? Fine, whatever. These are websites. Lil Brandon, who runs a really big operation, I'm sure. Go after your customers. Suing your customers is not good for business. So I tend to think it's a little bit of a bluff, but we'll see. It's definitely worth following. Obviously, if you have more questions about this from your particular scenario, you're free to reach out, but don't listen to, this is our general disclaimer. Don't view this as being your particular legal advice for your case. Okay. That said, we have Andy Schwartz on, who I mentioned is an economist. He helps found the Professional Collegiate League. So I want to get a little bit into name, image, and likeness. So, Mike, I know you've been keeping score, readily keeping score, where we stand across the country with name, image, and likeness laws. So give us where we stand. I know we have a couple for July 1st. We have a couple for maybe just one for late July. But give us the landscape, and then I want to kind of roundtable this.
So as we sit right now, there's 12 or 13 that have been signed into law. Georgia, we're waiting on the governor. South Carolina, we're also waiting on the governor. Currently, the first ones that will be in effect are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, if the governor signs it, I think they believe that the governor will sign it, Mississippi, and New Mexico. Those are July of this year, July 1st of this year. Arizona is also July 23rd. Of this year. So those are your six that are upcoming this year. The remaining that have been signed into law are Arkansas and South Carolina, which are 2022. Michigan is the end of 2022. California, Colorado, and Nebraska are in 2023. California and Colorado being January of 2023, Nebraska being July of 2023.
Mike, of the schools you mentioned, it's obviously a lot of schools in the South. So there is obviously some recruiting reason why we might have some more states that follow this July 1st date or late July or even 2021 with over 1,000 athletes in the transfer portal. I think time is of the essence to get name, image, likeness on the book. So Terrence, Stephanie, your thoughts on kind of the future of name, image, and likeness?
I, for one, shout out SEC for being on top of this. South Carolina graduate, go Cocks. But I, for one, am interested in figuring out, how these different schools are going to be now selling themselves to players and how they're now going to be able to sell endorsement plans essentially tailored to specific players as part of their recruitment pitches, which I think is going to bring a whole new layer. And who knows, maybe Alabama won't be at the top of, the college football arena for much longer if they can't figure out how to appeal to the endorsement. I mean, obviously Saban's still there, but there could be some dark horses who come out with these crazy good endorsement plans and have a great marketing team, and all of a sudden these great players want to go there.
No, I definitely agree with you there, Steph. And I'm excited for Andy to get into that, and he can kind of talk about California side and their new bill too, about, you know, having their bill being effective sooner rather than later because of that competition. And I think that's another thing that people, you know, schools, NCAA was sticking to that same argument back when there was the NCAA versus Miller case, where they said, you know, different state laws is actually a disadvantage to these athletes. It's a competitive disadvantage because one state might have a better bill than the other state. And so then athletes who are in one state have a disadvantage under their name, image, and likeness versus another state's. So I definitely agree with you there, Steph.
It's a good time to bring in our guest, Andy Schwartz. So Andy, I've seen his name around for years. We started going back and forth on Twitter maybe a few months back. Andy has been, we'll say, the expert economist on a number of sports cases. You can look him up. But Andy is very involved in the NCAA front. So we got in with Andy. We talked about antitrust issues. We talked about the future of the NCAA, the overtime league, the one that everyone's talking about in high school. Andy obviously has a competing league, professional collegiate league, which caters to college age players, but that are getting paid to play, while overtime caters to high school players. So a little bit of drama, I think, in the creation of the overtime league, which I'm sure we'll get into. So with that said, let us turn it over to Andy Schwartz.
Andy, welcome to Contract Detrimental. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much for having me on.
So you and I have been going back and forth on Twitter probably for a couple years at this point, but people that are familiar with your work, obviously we're having you on for two reasons. Number one, because you're a great follow on Twitter, and Andy will shout out your handle and all that fun stuff. But the other one is that you are the founder and chief innovation officer at the Professional Collegiate League. So on this podcast and on all forms of, and any type of platform we have, the NCAA is obviously a very large sticking point when it comes to sports law. From the Alston case, from the battles going on in the state legislature, maybe even the federal legislature, NCAA issues keep coming up. So let me turn it to you. Can you kind of give us your background on how you kind of inserted yourself with the PCL in this conversation of sports and law and issues with the NCAA?
Sure. So I'm an antitrust economist. I do most of my work within the litigation world. The very, very first case I worked on after leaving grad school was a lawsuit that Al Davis filed against the NFL, not the famous Raiders cases that people cite from this Ninth Circuit, but a follow-on case when they wanted to come back to Oakland. And from there, I kept becoming expert on really arcane elements of the rule of reason with respect to economics and sports. And so at some point I was asked to help on a paper about what the NFL does with respect to its rules is sort of more kosher economically than what the NCAA does with respect to its collective agreements. And from there have now been involved in the White v. NCAA case, the O'Bannon v. NCAA case, Alston. There's new litigation going on. There's a lot of spots where if you have an organization and the central premise of your organization is that you have to collude to keep down compensation, that you're going to bump into antitrust law, because generally speaking, antitrust law frowns on collusion to keep down compensation. And so that's sort of how I got involved in it. The reason that the PCL exists is because when we won in the O'Bannon case, and even though the remedy that was offered at the time was fairly tepid, it was essentially your current compensation can't be any lower than, you can pay whatever you want. I mean, recognize this is antitrust. It's not about mandates. It's about prohibitions on collusion. The collusion cannot prohibit pay below COA, which is what schools did. COA stands for cost of attendance. The judge also said that you can't limit deferred compensation to zero. If you want to pick a limit, it's got to be more than $5,000. That was very small. The evidence and certainly the reaction of the schools was, if you let us cap it at 2,000, pay will rise to 2,000 right away. If you let us cap it at 5,000, pay will rise to 5,000 right away, which is a sign that in fact the market rate is higher than 5,000, because things don't bump up against the ceiling on day one if the ceiling is too high. They only bump up against the ceiling if the ceiling is too low. The Ninth Circuit tossed that part of the remedy out. The injunction was limited to just the cost of attendance piece, not the deferred compensation piece, which is why schools are allowed to collude currently to keep deferred compensation to zero. that frustrated me to no end, because we had spent 5 years on the O'Bannon case explaining to a judge who was not super familiar with sports, let alone college sports, why market principles in an antitrust case made sense. And then really two judges, one of them was not even a sitting Ninth Circuit appeals court judge. It was someone from one of the Michigan district courts sitting by designation, said sort of, you know, without evidence, it wasn't a footnote, you'll ruin sports if you do this. And so it was like,
they say that a lot, Andy, always, that the sport will be ruined. And then it's
like, and like, we had spent 5 years factually building up a record to convince the district court judge why that argument was false. And the circuit court was like, yeah, no. So that was really frustrating to me. And so, you know, if it didn't seem like there was going to be any possibility of legislation, litigation wasn't working. At around the same time, the folks at Northwestern had tried to unionize, and that had not worked. And so in my mind, I was like, well, if the world is ever going to change in my lifetime, there's only one option left, which is competition. If there is a firm that is depressing wages in an industry to the point where the best talent is consistently underpaid, that's a market opportunity to enter the market, pay more, and essentially become the best organization in the industry. Imagine if all of the good trial lawyers were having their compensation somehow held down to $100 an hour, how good of a trial law firm you could create if you came in and paid $300 an hour to everybody and essentially competed against the cartel. That's the premise behind the PCL. We're a college league. All of our athletes will be in college, but we're a professional league. So we're the professional collegiate league. And the idea is that we think what makes college sports popular is that it's great sports played by college athletes. And you can say all that without mentioning their compensation at all. It's not the National Amateur Athletic Association. It's the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Again, the amateurism is not part and parcel of that. And it's really important to recognize the first time in college sports that there was ever a nationally enforced amateurism rule was 1956. The success or failure of the sport was not created by amateurism. And in fact, this idea that it's an essential part of the product is false. It was imposed on the product after the fact. You could argue there's a causation correlation thing, but 1956 is just about when college football becomes less popular than the NFL. So the moment at which compensation is now restricted is also the moment at which consumer demand goes down, not up.
Let me just break out the PCL league, and then I want to get into some more NIL stuff. PCL covers all sports or covers one particular sport?
We are launching with men's basketball. Essentially, a lot of our money comes from tech, and every time we go out and try to get the right number of investors, one of the things we hear is like, is there a way that you can beta test your concept? Is there a way that we can do a small sandbox version? And I joke like, well, I could play basketball and that might be a small version. But we hope once we've proven it, the concept with men's basketball, to quickly add women's basketball. And then from there to begin adding other sports. So we're the professional collegiate league, but our first product will be professional collegiate league basketball.
I guess on that, the logical question, I was aware of your league, the PCL league, for some amount of time. And then maybe it was a couple months ago, this overtime league started to pop up. And it's a different model. I think I understand the premise as being you are basically a high schooler and you are just earning money. You don't have to go to the pro, you don't have to go to the NCAA level. I guess my question, so for those that don't know the overtime league, basically they're going to pay their, at least the plan, if it's ever going to get off the ground, is to pay their athletes about $100,000 or somewhere six figures to play when they're playing high school. Now, Andy, as I see you, the PCL league, you are basically creating a lane where people can get a college education and also play basketball on the side. Is there a world where the overtime league and the PCL league can coexist with one another?
Oh, very much so. So first of all, Aaron Ryan, who is running that league, interviewed with us to work for us at one point. So, you know, I definitely think he took I'm not accusing anybody. I think he understood what we were trying to do. And essentially you could see that they're doing something similar, but at a more youthful age. A thing that I don't understand about their business model right now, I think there are things that are plenty fine about it, is they are operating under the principle that their athletes will be able to play NCAA basketball. What's his name? Alexis Ohanian, Mr. Serena Williams, recently tweeted, hey, can we does anyone have any way of getting around this silly like the fact that they're like thinking that they're going to figure out a way to convince the NCAA that someone who was paid from age 15, which is fine, like, you know, soccer players get paid from age 15 all the time, but soccer players who play at age 15 and get paid don't play college soccer. They're not eligible. The idea that someone could get paid for 4 years of high school, $100,000 each, and that he will somehow preserve his amateur status is not going to happen. And like, oh, well, NIL is coming. I know we're going to talk about NIL a lot. That is not what a name, image, and likeness deal is. That is compensation for athletic services, which in the NCAA world is the dreaded pay for play. That will be the very last thing that the NCAA gives up in terms of compensation restrictions. So I don't understand where they think these guys are going to go. So with that said, their model, they're only going to have at most 30 athletes total. We're a league that's aiming for our initial eight teams to be around 96 athletes. We hope to hit 24 teams by the time we get to steady state. That's a much broader set of athletes. So if you take 4 years of high school and you have 30 guys, say 32, that's eight a year. So they're only going to be graduating from their program eight guys a year. And maybe there's room for them to essentially go into the G League, which has the G League Elite now, which last year had six guys plus some older six people in that one and done slot.
We'll say studs. How about that? Blue chippers.
Yeah, although I think only three of them are looking like they're going to get drafted. So there's still this problem of what do you do with an OTE guy who maybe isn't good enough to play in the NBA right away if one and done is gone, isn't good enough to be on the stud list, or is, but then like there's a pipeline problem that both of these organizations have. Now, the G League is fine because they say to them, look, if you go to the NBA, great. If you don't, you can stay in the G League. But that's not what a 15-year-old wants to hear, which is, oh, yeah, when you finish this, you can go play in the G League. They want to play in the NBA. But until that's available, they should recognize that they're not going to play for Duke, Kentucky, North Carolina, the traditional path to the NCAA. And I don't think that they've really thought this through. I think Carmelo Anthony was quoted as saying things like, you know, like, well, we hope to work with them. It's like, well, good luck. But for us, we think this is a great opportunity because if everybody who's good at age 15 chooses to take a path that makes them ineligible to compete with our biggest competitors for talent, we think it's going to make our path just seem all the more viable. Now, this is sort of long term because they're going to be signing guys who are 15. We're going to be in year three or four by the time they're ready to go to college. But I think we're really well positioned to take advantage of this. The other thing that's really good about it is that they have successfully tapped into the venture capital community. Andreessen Horowitz, I think, is their big backer. That's Mark Andreessen, who invented Netscape and all those things. And coincidentally, is the son-in-law of the single biggest athletic donor at Stanford. And that's sort of like a mark of validation. There are some very, very creative people in finance, and there are a lot of people who are making a lot of money copying other people. And so for us, having it established that there's a valuation, well, how do you value a league that pays their athletes about $100,000 and provides some form of education on the side that is generally essentially trying to replace the amateur version of high school basketball? Well, we sound a lot like that. And so it's making it a lot easier for us in our conversations.
Yeah, it's really cool, I think, to have all of these different laboratories of innovation to find out, you know, what's next. And I think that the number of people that PCL has on its various boards really speaks to the quality of the idea. So I'm really excited to see what comes of it.
Yeah. Andy, we're excited.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you here. Your Twitter was mentioned earlier. I think you have probably one of the best Twitter names that I've seen presented by Envelopes of Cash, which is just like a great jab at the Rocket Mortgage thing. So the PCL has got three teams. One question that I have, especially as it relates to NIL, is that it seems like a lot of the NIL strength, especially in college, could be generated from the power of the programs. Like you go play at Texas football, like you're going to get more followers, you'll be a bigger deal, or, you know, Duke for basketball. How does a startup league, and you guys are based mostly mid-Atlantic on the East Coast, how do you sort of generate that same amount of interest to be able to boost the NIL that they can earn?
I don't disagree that if you bring your IP to an organization that has strong brand itself, that there's potential for synergy. But I think it's really overrated. And I think overtime is an example of this, this idea that high-end basketball talent needs a Duke to label them as good consumable content, a strong brand in and of itself. Zion Williamson had more followers on his various social media and more views on his YouTube in high school than Duke basketball did.
Right.
So obviously the ACC has a very prominent placement on the ESPN calendar. And that's really important for building a brand. And that's why our recent deal with Next Level to have our games available in 49 countries, and 40 some countries, and essentially to get exposure is really important for our growth. But that's an advantage that the incumbents have, and that even overtime hasn't matched yet. I don't think that there's much, the legacy brand of these schools is strong, but I don't think that it is hard to replace, in the sense that if you can imagine, if essentially the lottery picks from next year's draft were all playing in the PCL, do you think we would have difficulty getting people to tune in to our games? The eyeballs will follow the talent. And to the extent to which, if overtime is going to be successful, then that has to be the case that you can get people to watch young men playing basketball without the name of a university in front of their shirt.
Well, I think that that's true to an extent, but even with G League Ignite this year, I don't know if their games were that accessible. So I think that you pointed to something that is a big deal, that the ACC is very accessible. You turn on your TV on any random Wednesday and Syracuse and Duke or whoever are going to be facing off. And that wasn't necessarily the case for the G League Ignite thing. So I think that
So you should have to ask Sharif Abdurrahim about that. I think that the G League, they don't know what to do with the Ignite. They were planning to have them be sort of like the Harlem Globetrotters, not like goofy basketball, but in the sense of literally going around the world playing essentially a series of friendlies against the Spanish basketball team, some Turkish league team, like essentially a world tour of these 18, 19 year old guys against the best the world can offer. And then COVID hit. And so they couldn't do any of that. And so they threw them into the G League bubble. Problem there is that the G League is not an exciting consumer product. And this is really important. I think, like, if you think about the big three as another thing, I think that there is much more excitement in watching a young future star, whether it's high school or college, than there is in watching a guy who was good and didn't quite make it. So that's sort of the G League model, or was great, but is now old, which is sort of the big three model. And like, there's a reason why in baseball, if they have an old timers game, they have one a season. They don't have 162 old timers games, because nostalgia can only get you so far. But like, even minor league baseball is actually a fairly popular thing because it's got future folks in it. But if you only have the people who don't make the cut, I think it's a very different product. And I think that was what hurt the Ignite, was they were playing against a bunch of didn't quite make it.
I think we've kind of spoke a lot about what the problems with the NCAA are, and obviously your PCL league, the overtime league, the G League, those are all alternatives to going to the NCAA and doing that model. Now, why is sports law and the NCAA keep intersecting? It's outside of Alston or O'Bannon. It's really this conversation that's occurring in the legislature. So as of today, and obviously anything can change over the next week, we keep getting new states. There are 5 states across the country that have effective dates for their NIL laws as being July 1st. The 5th state was Georgia, and then you have a combination of Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and New Mexico. So there are, of those 5, 4 schools are in SEC country. So you're reading the writing on the wall, SEC schools will follow, and then there's going to be some type of recruiting level. So by the time, we're in the beginning of May now, by the time July 1st comes, you can have another 5 states that are effective July 1st. Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you because I know you're really into this topic. I mean, I guess, Andy, my thoughts on this, I think we're setting up for a tremendous battle between the NCAA and these states. But I don't know, Mike, what do you think here?
Andy, welcome. This is the second time we've had you on. Last time we had you on was 3 years ago, and you were talking about Alston way back then, and we're going to talk about it now then, today too. So just welcome back. And like Dan said, we have these five states. I think Arizona is also the end of July, so July 23rd of 2021. So I would also throw them in there. I think what we have now is we have the battle of the dates. I think that's the toughest struggle we have. So I think with the recent news of Florida, they had the delay threat, I guess. They were going to push back the time that this bill would go into effect. And the whole state, you know, blew up. You had college coaches, you know, talking, saying, you know, Florida was the prime example of NIL and pushing forward to this new age of college sports. How do you see that playing out with other states? And do you actually see a potential for states to actually try to have their bill effective date come closer to that 7/1/2021 date?
Yeah, well, so just real quickly, you know, I was involved in the first state in California. It was Nancy Skinner was my state senator, and she invited me to an event, and she said, what could I do for college athletes? And I said, well, why don't you make it, you know, pass an NIL bill in California? And then she got elected and it went from there. When we were pushing that bill, everybody said that this was going to be horrible, da 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 da. Fast forward on that one day when Florida temporarily postponed putting their bill into effect for a year, all of the same organizations like the University of Florida that had said, this is going to be horrible in when we were trying to get it passed, they'd already gotten to the like, But we've been planning on this, and this is going to be great. And why would we delay it for a year? So the world has already changed in terms of perspective. To your point, to get our bill through in California, we had to put in a 3-year or 2.5-year grace period. The California bill as written now doesn't go into effect until January 1, 2023. And that was because there was a committee chairman saying, I don't want to be in a game of chicken against the NCAA where they say they're going to kick us out and we want to give them some time to work things out. And it wouldn't have gotten out of committee otherwise. Well, so, and then Florida, Darren Heitner led that charge down there. They put a faster, a sooner date on it. And that's great. California, in the meantime, has another bill. So a follow-up bill, which does a few things. And one of them I think is really important is that it adds athletic reputation to the NIL. And let's put that to the side and talk about it in a second. But another thing that it does is it moves up the date. It's either going to now be January 1 of 2022, so 7 months from now-ish, 8 months from now, or whenever the NCAA passes any rule changing its NIL rules, which when everyone thought that was going to be August 1, it doesn't look like that's actually going to happen now. So yeah, once the ice has been broken and the world has shifted, California is like, well, we don't want to be left behind. And it makes sense because essentially what, first of all, I mean, I think we should think about this. There's nothing stopping the University of Arizona on July 1 from making offers, even if their state doesn't mandate them to compete until July 23rd or whatever day it is. I don't know why they would have picked that day. There's nothing that's stopping the University of Nevada, you know, Las Vegas from doing it, even though Nevada doesn't have an NIL bill, because it is not illegal currently to ask a college athlete to be in an advertisement. It is not illegal to ask a college athlete to make a personal appearance for money. It's against the NCAA rules. All that these state laws are doing is making it illegal for their schools to participate in the conspiracy to prevent people from earning the money. So it's a very different thing. The school could still choose not to participate in that conspiracy.
So spinning off on the conspiracy, I think a touch away from NIL and going to Alston, of the current kind of updates going on with Alston, with these extra permissible benefits and the caps on these limits that the NCAA has, and where do you see that movement with the Supreme Court ruling that should be coming probably next month, I guess, on the same kind of train track with name, image, and likeness?
Yeah. So I think that before, I don't know what you guys thought, before the oral arguments that we all got a chance to watch or listen to, I was quite pessimistic, sort of off the same experience that I had with the Ninth Circuit in O'Bannon, which is you bump up another level And you're essentially moving from a world of fact to a world of impression. Clarence Thomas is not going to read Dan Rasher's expert report and understand, or even, you know, read the detailed stuff about the 1938-1939 Pitt team and whether they went on strike or not. In his mind, the NCAA has always been amateur. And so it felt like we were going to be in this world where it was going to be a lot of plausible sounding falsehoods instead of being fact-based. But it wasn't that. It may not have been very fact-based, but it would, the what people came into, including a lot of people that I wouldn't have expected, like Samuel Alito, was very anti-NCAA. And so I think that up till that point, my sense is that the NCAA thought, at this point, now that we've gotten cert to the Supreme Court in Alston, we are made. We are going to get a really strong ruling that says that the grand tradition of amateurism, the revered tradition, must be preserved. And that's going to allow us to just roll into court on July 1, asking for I never know the difference between a preliminary injunction and a temporary restraining order because I'm not a lawyer, but asking for some sort of stay of these laws.
They're pretty similar, Andy. You can, for this purpose, you can say they're the same thing.
Okay. Asking for a stay of these, you know, enjoining the states from enforcing these laws because they violate the revered tradition of amateurism and things like that. I think a lot of that, I mean, I know we're all reading tea leaves, but it's very hard to imagine that oral argument leading to a resounding win for the NCAA where they say, and if they're paid for their name, image, and likeness, by the way, that's bad too, right? Like, and so I don't know what that, I've been told it by very smart people, there is a real dormant commerce clause problem with a state trying to regulate the NCAA, see Miller, you know, v. Nevada or Tarkanian or whatever that case was about Nevada trying to change NCAA rules with state law. And I've been told by really, really smart people that there's no problem at all. So I don't know the answer to this, but if I had to bet, I would bet that the NCAA is going to ask the courts to, like, they're going to ask for it, and they get a lot of deference. So they'll probably get a stay even if they end up losing. Maybe not, they won't get the injunction, but they'll at least get a temporary injunction before the temporary injunction can be decided. And so, yeah, I think we're going to see, that's the first thing we're going to see. The only wrinkle is Alston might come out in June, right? If Alston comes out in June and just says, the Neil Gorsuch argument was something to the effect of, look, if you've got market power in this industry, you can't define your product as price fixed product. That's crazy. And if somehow Neil Gorsuch writes the opinion, like, you know, maybe all bets are off, but I think that there's a really low probability of that. So
to the extent that there is an issue between Florida, let's say, or any of these states in the NCAA, there is nothing stopping, and just like you guys are trying to create the PCL League and the overtime leagues being created, there's nothing stopping Florida from, we'll say, you know, seceding from the NCAA and starting their own version, right? If you want to call it the Coastal Conference of Florida.
Yeah, it's a little different, though, I think, and this is where economists, my actual expertise can come in as opposed to opining on the law. Florida is a beneficiary of the general NCAA cartel because they don't have to pay salaries to their athletes. If they break away and form this separate league.
I like the Coastal League. That sounds pretty good.
The Coastal League.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to not, it's not going to be an NIL only league. They're not going to be able to say that they have this revered tradition of amateurism that they have, that has to be respected. There's going to be price fixers. And so they're going to have real trouble unless they have employees and all that stuff. And I don't think that that's a step that any of those organizations want to take. And then the separate thing would be like, I think they would really be opening themselves up for back damages for all the years that they were engaged in it, and that they've now just proven that actually we don't need it at all to compete. So there's that.
So, you know, I mean, the reason I bring it up, Andy, we do our research for the show. We'll say Stephanie is one of our super researchers. Stephanie came upon a quote of yours. You look nervous here. It's not a bad quote. Don't worry. But Stephanie, I'm gonna give it to you. It's on point just with the destruction of the NCAA. Go ahead, Steph.
Well, first I have to give you a fun fact, Andy. It's actually a compliment that my grandfather sent me. So last summer, my grandfather had emailed me an article that you wrote, and he said, well, do you want to know why I'm sending you this? Because his dad was my former housemate at Stanford.
Oh, wow.
Richard Dick Barnes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know. My dad knows him real well.
Yep. So shout out Grandpa for making that connection. Yeah, yes. I told him you were going to be on and he was very excited.
What's sad is that they are the same age and that means that I'm a whole generation, like I'm that much older than you. I'm right. Because it's your grandpa and my dad. No, that's cool. We're 2 degrees of separation.
But anyways, back to the quote. There was a 2015 article that you wrote for Vice that I found, and you were criticizing a New Yorker article titled Why NCAA Athletes Shouldn't Be Paid.
Yes.
And in that you referenced, you know, how scandals involving paying athletes in the past, and said that not only these are not, as the author of that article argued, what happens when college sports are reduced to a market. And you said rather they're actually the symptoms of a market that has been stifled, of a culture that says that money paid directly to athletes is somehow dirty, while money paid to university employees to ensure said athletes are kept away from money is pure and good. So I'm assuming you probably think that all of this legislation has been a long time coming. But when did you first realize how big of a deal this might become? And could you have predicted the way that different states have been reacting by either jumping on the bandwagon and signing these bills versus not signing?
There's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I want to just point out how well written that sentence was. But
I agree.
I started about thinking about this as an antitrust person and thinking about this as an economic. What's good for the economy, for a micro industry, et cetera, et cetera. I have come around to realizing this is a civil rights issue. Every, you know, full citizen in America should have the right, among other things, to access to markets that are free of collusion. And so that the Sherman Act and its follow-ons is one of our rights. It's not a constitutional right, but it's a strong legal right that we all have. And when it's being abridged, and there are times that we do abridge it. It should be done as a policy issue by the a state legislature or the federal government, and it should be done very, very hesitantly. So an example is we're not allowed to sell ourselves into slavery. That's in some sense infringing on my economic right to sell myself into slavery. But we have decided as a country that this is a good thing, that the conditions under which one would be compelled to do that are not really economic freedom. It's actually economic oppression. And so we've banned it. It's prohibited under the Constitution. We have a few other things, like there's weird laws against, I think it's illegal to sell organs, right? That's another thing. You can see why we would do that, even though it's an abridgment on a pure laissez-faire economy. I just don't think that college athletic services fall into that right, into that spot. And so if we're going to say, and especially without federal mandate, just allow a private organization to cartelize an organization, it really is putting the convenience of a bunch of sports producers over the rights of a bunch of athletes. And those athletes, like it's weird. Like, you know, and a lot of times when you hear somebody come out and make arguments like I'm making that kind of sound very Republican, which I'm not, but very, you know, markets are good and we should let markets work. It's usually, I know they're not fair. I know it's going to flow money up to the top, but it's better if we have, you know, if someone might say, and therefore we tax it and we deal with the after effects on the redistribution side elsewhere. But here's a situation where the market would actually work in this progressive way because it would bring money to the bottom. The same people who have all the talent in this market are also, for the majority of them, come from very low socioeconomic backgrounds. More than half of the athletes who play FBS football are on Pell Grants, which means that their families are at or below the poverty level. And so you've got this crazy situation where this one spot where America's like, oh no, we can't be capitalist here, is the one spot where it would actually, like, the markets would drive money to the bottom of the socioeconomic scale, to the top of the talent scale. When the state laws are coming into effect and saying you can no longer do this, I really think, so first of all, it's about name, image, and likeness. Immediately when the NCAA heard about this, they started saying, like, well, if you're in a commercial and you're wearing your school's logo, that's forbidden because the school's logo is not your name, image, and likeness, right? So in California, we've added to this follow-on bill athletic reputation, because in the same way that, you know, you might have to get permission from the Dallas Cowboys if you're Dak Prescott to be in a chunky soup ad, but there's no law against it. You're not denied the ability to make a three-way deal between you, Campbell Soup, and the Cowboys if that's the optimal transaction here. But essentially, already we see things in Congress, we see the NCAA trying to really limit this down. But so the states are restoring, they're moving people from being second-class citizens to being like 1.9 class citizens, but it's not a full citizenship yet. And that's really, if you had to boil down what the PCL is about, is that we want to build a league on the premise that our athletes have the same economic rights as our coaches, as our investors, as our fans who are consumers, and that the system, like one fundamental premise of economics is that when two people engage in a non-coercive arm's length transaction, both sides are better off. When you buy food at the grocery store is happy with your money and you're happy with the food. If you weren't happy with the food, especially if you bought anything other than like gruel, if you weren't happy with the food, you don't have to buy it, right? You don't have to. And so it's a voluntary transaction. And that we think that the best way to really to produce any product, but particularly to produce a sports product, is recognizing the humanity and citizenship of the athletes.
Hey, Andy, you've had a couple of good references, under the radar gruel reference right there. Much appreciated.
You know, just some like minimum subsistence food.
Yes, I know why you are so funny on Twitter. I see it. We'll leave you with this lovely question. We keep getting in any number of levels, right? Where we are trending towards, I don't know if we're going to ever get there, and people, you know, maybe Old Takes Exposed will listen to this and he'll call us out. We're trending towards a world where there is a federal name, image, and likeness bill. Okay, so the current name, image, and likeness landscape, it's a little messed up. You got like 10 states and they're all a little bit different. You're having a recruiting war. But let's say you get to the point where there is federal name, image, and likeness, right? And there is a across the board name, image, and likeness. Now, does that world fix the NCAA's problems? And if you have a world where there is federal name, image, and likeness, where every state in the country and every school in the country has the same, laws that they have to adhere to, does that demolish what you're trying to do with the PCL League? So I know I'm giving you a lot, yeah, but I think that's, you know, the billion dollar question where we're heading towards.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. The first one is a really important societal question. The second one is one that I get asked by investors a lot. And so chance for me to address it here. The answer to both of them is no, that it doesn't fix the NCAA and it doesn't demolish what we're trying to do. In terms of the NCAA, like I said, the state laws that we're getting right now are addressing a fraction of it. It's ending one particular restriction of college athletes' rights, which is their ability to essentially engage with third parties. But it preserves, that's the molehill. The mountain is the prohibition of engaging with their actual would-be employer for direct compensation. It's sort of like saying, like, well, we're going to let waiters and waitresses earn tips now, but you don't have to pay them salaries. Like, the tips are supposed to be the piece on top, your sponsorship. I know that maybe Kevin Durant makes more money from endorsements than he does from salary, but the average guy in the NBA, his salary is the most important part of his earnings, and the endorsements are a nice cream on top. We're essentially saying to these college athletes, have some cream. I hope you didn't want to have any actual substance here. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's really important. I don't know of a single federal bill, with the possible exception of the one that was introduced by Senator Murphy, that's been proposed, that's as strong as either the Florida or the California laws are. So the federal process is going to take what seems like a small step, a non-complete step, and cut it in half, shrink it down. The one that the NCAA recently endorsed, the Cleaver-Gonzalez bill, specifically adds new legal restrictions on what college athletes can do. So it's actually taking rights away. And I think I said this a moment ago, but I think that's the real problem, is that until a bill comes out of Congress which says you can't treat college athletes differently than you treat college coaches in terms of setting their pay, limiting how much they get paid to do a radio show on the side, da 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 da, all those things, that they won't really be full citizens. As for what we're doing, it really flows out of that. We're paying salaries. There won't be salaries even if there's a federal NIL bill. We're allowing athletes to commercialize in ways like shoe deals. The NCAA in their proposals all say that they've carved out shoe deals. Why? Well, because shoe deals have paid people under the table in the past. That's a sign that that's the most valuable endorsements to get. It's pretty obvious that if you're a basketball player, that unless you have some other weird thing, like you also are a great singer or whatever, the single biggest reason that somebody's going to want you to endorse their product is because you make the product look good when you use it. And the thing that you're going to make look the best are sneakers. And so saying that you can't have that product as your thing, like, so we think we're going to have a much stronger offering there. And similarly, just the general premise that essentially our athletes are all going to have an LLC, and that LLC is going to be treated in the same neutral way as any other business that we interact with, and not in this sort of like, it's this combination of paternalism, which you could argue, well, paternalism is offensive, but at least you're looking out for them. But it's like a malevolent paternalism, where it's like, I'm the bad dad. I'm not going to let you earn this money. Why? Well, because you might spend it wrong. So I'm going to take it and I'm going to spend it wrong. And that's sort of the world that we have. This is cracking that open just a smidge, but it's really an important step, but it's only a first step. So no, and I guess I worry that if there is a federal bill and it does that first step and then it locks things in, that may be the end. So it's a great business opportunity for us. The more the NCAA is locked in, if there are rules that make it illegal for schools to pay their athletes, that is the single best thing for the PCL. Because then imagine if you wanted to enter an industry and it was legal for you to pay your talent, but it was illegal for your competitors to do so. How easy it would be to get the best talent.
Very fair. Well, Andy, I know we kept you a little bit longer than we had initially promised, but it was an absolute pleasure having you on. And we'll probably have you back on as the chaos continues at the NCAA level, but super appreciate Andy taking the time.
Thanks. It was great talking to you all. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
So that was Andy Schwartz. As Andy mentioned, Andy is the co-founder of the PCL League. You can find more info on the PCL League at thepclleague.com. Andy is on Twitter at AndyHRE. So in wrapping this episode, I know this went a little long, but obviously we had a lot of topics to discuss. What to watch for seems to be a popular segment that my wife's friends tell me that they skip to the end of the podcast to listen to, which Taryn seems a lot like Ryan Rosillo's podcast with life advice, which maybe we will steal at some point. But Taryn, let me turn it over to you. What to watch for, Taryn? What are we looking for in the horizon?
Really excited to see, Duke has been pursuing this great recruit for the last 3 years, Patrick Baldwin. He's supposed to announce tomorrow, so we'll see whether he picks Duke. Now, I know that people are talking about Duke because of Zion again, but I think that's a big nothing burger. Look, his stepfather was the AAU coach, which for a team that was sponsored by Adidas, and he received like $5,000 over 9 payments. Like, that money is not going to get any kid to go to your school, let alone a player of the caliber of Zion's. So yeah, I don't think that there's much of a connection there. And surprise, the AAU guys are getting paid by the shoe companies. I'm not sure that we learned anything new in this Brian Bowen thing, but we'll keep an eye out. I know that Duke drives a lot of traffic.
What I have been watching and what I'm looking forward to is tomorrow, being May 6th, Gerrit Cole, first time facing the Houston Astros, Yankee jersey, Yankee pinstripes. The series has been going great so far. I love that the Yankees are just beating up on the Astros. I think it's great for baseball to see the Astros lose at everything. So that is what I'm looking forward to tomorrow, watching Gerrit Cole.
Fans in the Bronx finally got to boo the Astros. That's a long time coming.
Okay, Steph, what do you got?
I am starting to look forward to the NBA playoffs because it's shaping up to be kind of interesting, which I was not expecting just because of all the injuries. But Lakers Blazers matchup on Friday could determine whether LeBron has to play in the play-in tournament. He's not going to be happy about that, but you know, it's shaping up to be what might be a really good playoffs. And I wasn't expecting that, but I'm excited to see Kevin Durant, Kyrie, James Harden do their thing for the Nets and hopefully bring home another championship to New York.
So Steph, I guess carrying it on that point, you were a witness to a wager I made legally in the state of West Virginia. We won't talk about the whole backstory, but I had $50 I had to spend on a futures bet because FanDuel, the sportsbook, shut down at like 11, which was insane. But I had to place a futures bet. So what did I do? I put $50 on the Milwaukee Bucks to win the NBA title at 10.5-1 odds. That number is shrinking. I think last I checked, it's at like 6.5. So I got to get a decent amount of money. I might need to take a trip back to West Virginia to collect on that at some point. But what I am watching for is a little ways away, but the announcement came this week, September 4th, 2021. The Nebraska Cornhuskers have their home opener against the Fordham Rams.
Oh, what a coincidence.
Because somebody might have gone to school at Fordham Law School. And someone might also be an honorary Cornhusker who may or may not be followed by the University of Nebraska's president. And that someone may be me. So did I broker this deal? I'm not sure if I can tell you, because if I told you, I'd have to kill all of you. But I'm very excited for this game. I was debating, not debating, I was asking my lovely wife, who almost made a cameo on this podcast, if we could go down for the game. But my wife is due at the end of July, and anyone that can deal with young kids. So I don't know how fair it would be to ask my wife to take care of a 2-month-old and our 2-year-old, just having given birth about 6 weeks prior. I think that would result in me no longer having a wife. But I'm definitely going to watch the game. I don't know if I can go there unless they pay for my flight. If they pay for my flight in Nebraska, if you're listening, if you pay for my flight, I might have to go. But that's
flight and a nanny.
And the nanny. Well, we probably would give the kids to my parents, but like, I don't know. I'd probably go alone, which would be really weird. I feel like I have to do a family trip. I feel like I have to do that.
Why not just make your
we do a live episode
a Cornhusker from the jump?
Somebody said, and I'm not going to shout them out because, you know, I don't want to encourage this, but they said that I should go down to Nebraska now and stay there for 2 months so that my child is going to be born in the state of Nebraska. I'll be a resident of Nebraska.
Hard.
People listen to the podcast that don't follow me elsewhere. The state of Nebraska has a healthy obsession with sports law lust. They love what I have to sell.
This isn't even a bit anymore. Like, they really have adopted you as one of their own.
I literally wrote, so I saw Front Office Sports posted about Nebraska's new state-of-the-art athletic facility. And I just wrote, per sources, there is no place like Nebraska. 200 likes on Twitter. And I didn't even do anything. And like the wide receiver, one of the wide receivers on the team retweeted it. Beat reporters, they're like, this guy sports a lust. He just loves us. He just loves talking about Nebraska. So like, you know what I do? I do. It's reciprocal. I love Nebraska. So I think with that said, guys, anything to add before we put this in the books?
Congrats to Steph. She graduated law school.
Well, technically don't graduate until the 27th, but you know, us girls had to take our big photo shoot before. So that was that.
The champagne's not going to spray itself. You had to take photos with that champagne.
I had to chug the champagne after as well.
Totally understood. Signing off, Dan Wallach, who is not with us today, is at Wallach Legal. As always, I am at Sports All Lust on Instagram and Twitter. Mike is at Mike_son_of_law. Taryn is at TK Sharma Law. And Stephanie is at S Weisenberger _ and at Steph Explains It All. With the Conduct Detrimental Family, rate, review, subscribe, all that fun stuff. And we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.